Ramana, welcome to Cable again.
Thank you, Bill.
Ramana started as a physicist who came to be alarmed by the spread of nuclear weapons. He's taught, researched, written, and agitated at the Nuclear Futures Laboratory and the Program on Science and Global Security, both at Princeton University. He's now at the University of British Columbia School of Public Policy and Global Affairs. Ramana is a member of the International Nuclear Risk Assessment Group and the team that produces the annual World Nuclear Industry Status Report, which unfortunately gets longer and more alarming every year. Over the years, Ramana has come to recognize that climate change joins nuclear weapons and nuclear accidents as imminent looming threats to human life, and he began studying energy, particularly how to replace both nuclear and fossil fuel energy, and in the process, restore planetary ecosystems. He and several colleagues recently wrote the article, How Electric Utilities Thwart Climate Action, Politics, and Power. That's in this month's edition of the journal Against the Current. The article discusses one of the several ways that investor-owned utilities and their financiers and investors try to remain in control and make their huge profits. How do they do that? By stretching out the time of getting to net zero and then slowly substituting big natural gas plants for the big coal-burning plants and later replacing gas with huge remote sun and wind farms. This, of course, ignores the science that calls for substantial reduction of gas concentrations in the near future. So, Ramana, tell us about that part of the investor-owned utility and financier and investor strategy.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is very important, and I'm thankful to you, Bill, for highlighting this in your program. Though there is now much greater recognition of the crisis that climate change poses and the necessity to reduce emissions quickly, these large electric utilities and electricity contributes a fairly substantial fraction of emissions in every country, the production of electricity. The utilities that own these large power plants have all tried to maintain their profitability and their revenue streams by talking about climate change, but trying to avoid changing their investment portfolios in any major way. As you mentioned, the one source of power they have moved away from to some extent is coal. Coal has used to be a very central element in the generation portfolios for most of these electric utility companies. But over the years, it has just received too much negative press. There are protesters on the street, and I think they've decided and maybe some of them have been genuinely convinced by the science of climate change to think that they should move away from coal. But the same science would also tell them that they should not be investing in natural gas plants. And this is for two reasons. The first is that natural gas plants also involve the burning of fossil fuels, and therefore when the natural gas is burnt at the plant, it will be emitting carbon dioxide. The amount of emissions of carbon dioxide per unit of electricity produced in a natural gas plant is about half of that of a coal plant. And so it's somewhat better than coal in one sense. But the natural gas plants, by their, as their name suggests, require the use of natural gas. And the natural gas has to be produced somewhere. In the United States, this is being fueled by the boom in what is called fracking, or hydraulic fracturing is the more technically accurate name. And we know from a number of studies that the places where the natural gas is extracted and how it is being transported to the different places where the natural gas is used, there are leaks all across the fuel chain. And when methane leaks, that is also a greenhouse gas. And in fact, in the short term, methane is much more powerful in terms of holding on to the radiation that is incoming from the sun and increasing the temperature than carbon dioxide. And therefore, when utility companies invest in natural gas plants, they are contributing to climate change. They will be continuing to contribute to climate change. But also, if you think about the way that the industry tries to sell that is to say natural gas is going to be a bridge fuel. Eventually, we will move to a much more renewable energy power future, but we are not there yet. And so right now, we need natural gas as a stepping stone. The problem there is that any of these power plants is a massive investment, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars. And when companies do those kinds of investments, they have to recoup those costs over an extended period of time. A typical lifetime, operating lifetime for any of these plants is about 40 years. So if a company is investing in a natural gas plant today, it is doing so under the expectation that this plant is going to be operating for the next 30, 40 years at least. Otherwise, it's going to be losing out money on that in that process. And so the switch to natural gas is not really going to help us with mitigating climate change as the time for much more rapid emissions approaches.
But they have another story, it seems to me, reading the corporate literature. Yes, we'll be producing and emitting natural gas. Natural gas wells, there are thousands and thousands in the United States. All of them leak. One has no idea of how much methane is in the atmosphere, although some studies apparently have been done in local areas, and it's more than anybody wants to admit. But they have another story, which is we are the leader in technology in the world. We've revolutionized production and communications in the United States in just a few years. Our engineers are top flight, and we're going to develop new technologies. They're on the drawing board, and some of them are even being tested, they say, that one way or another, some of them will absorb carbon dioxide. Some of them allegedly will change carbon dioxide into usable products, and they can capture it. And a lot of it could be sequestered. Carbon sequestering is one way, some kind of dream of reforestation. They're cutting down the forest, but they seem to think that they can grow enough forest to do all of the work. Most of it is just pie in the sky. It's talk. But they are getting away with it. And the small nukes is the worst of their new technologies. But these nukes, Ramana, they'll be safe. We reassure you. You can be sure. And there's no problem in where to put all that waste that's piling up now.
Yes, Ramana. Absolutely. Well, you put your finger on the thing. So they have another discursive strategy, if you like, you know, how they dress up what they are doing. And the term that has become very popular now is net zero. Rather than zero emissions, now they all aim to achieve what they call net zero emissions. And what does that mean? It's exactly what you said, that, you know, somehow you would assume that there would be a way to absorb carbon dioxide in somewhere else in the world that would compensate for the carbon dioxide that they are releasing. And how this is going to happen is envisioned to be through a mixture of familiar ways of absorbing carbon dioxide, like growing forests, and revolutionary new technologies that would absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and convert it into some solid product, either usable or something that can be kept underneath the ground somehow. Now, the problem with that is if you're thinking about carbon dioxide, absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, plants and trees do it, and they do it as part of their natural growth. But the problem there is, of course, that we are cutting down forests because of various requirements for land, and there is only a finite amount of land. And if you're going to be growing forests in places where people are growing food, for example, and typically these things happen in the developing world where, you know, there is acute conflicts over land as it is. But the more pie-in-the-sky strategy are these technologies that are supposed to be absorbing carbon dioxide using artificial means and putting it underground in some fashion or converting into usable products. The challenge there is that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has a very low concentration. You know, we know that it's 400 parts per million or 500 parts per million. This is the numbers that we hear about as the emissions are increasing. So you're trying to capture 400 to 500 molecules out of every million molecules that are there in the atmosphere. And as you can imagine, that kind of a process will require a very large amount of air to be sent through some surface, which will capture that carbon dioxide. And that's a very energy-intensive process. So what we are trying to talk about is that the greenhouse gas problem is fundamentally because of the ways we produce energy. And now we are going to try to use more energy to try and capture the carbon dioxide that has been put in there. Okay. The second issue with carbon capture is, again, the old problem of how to make it profitable. Now, because this is a hugely energy-intensive process and because it requires a lot of equipment, it is an expensive process. And the question is, who is going to pay for that and how is it going to be paid for? So the way that these technologies have been developed is to use it for something called enhanced oil recovery, which is that if you have an oil field where oil is being pumped out, the idea is that these carbon capture plants would try to capture carbon dioxide and pump it down into those old oil wells. And when this new carbon dioxide goes into the old oil well, it will push out some of the oil that's still stuck there, right? And so these fossil fuel companies have been trying to use carbon capture to increase their oil production, which if it sounds kind of contradictory, then it is contradictory.
It's absurd because then they burn the oil.
Exactly.
They tell that to politicians. They have scientists who work on it. If you go, I think of this, to the Aramco, the Saudi Arabian oil company, on the first page in Aramco, they talk about their carbon capture technology and then proudly point out that it's being used to enhance their oil production. It's so absurd, but they have men and women in white, and women too, incidentally, in white lab coats doing all of these things. And it looks very high tech, of course. And the plants that they have, the plumbing is just, you know, very impressive. All of the pipes and tubes and everything, and the people, everything is nice and clean. It's just absurd, but they have the power to sell that stuff. They're sort of promoting themselves as recognizing the threat of climate change, and we're doing our part in dealing with it. That's what they're telling people. And
yeah, this points to two contradictions we have. One is, you know, in our capitalist system, as you know, Bill, everything has to be looked at through the lens of profitability, right? And so the only way these companies like Aramco and so on can increase their profits or keep their profits up is by continuing to produce fossil fuels right now, right? So that is one motivation that keeps them going. But there's a second and more underlying larger motivation that's not just the fossil fuel companies, but the many other entities in the corporate world and in the political world that support these, which is the idea that somehow the system is good as it is, it's fine, and we need to maintain the current social, political, and economic system to the extent possible while, quote-unquote, mitigating climate change. Okay, and people have to be convinced that those who are in power know the answers to how to solve climate change. And that's why there's this great pretense about how new technology, revolutionary technology, is going to come in and solve all the problems. You mentioned small modular nuclear reactors. That's one sort of one of the suite of these technologies that are supposed to come in and save the world. There are sort of all of the technologies that we talked about in carbon capture and storage are like that. And even to some extent, some of the things that could be associated with renewable energy, like hydrogen. And there's a lot of hype about it precisely because the ruling class requires us to have narratives that show them saving the world, even though it's apparent to everybody that we are going to hell in a handbasket.
Yes, their hypocrisy is boundless, for they argue we must preserve the current system because we're on the road to wiping out poverty and disease. In fact, they are perfectly happy with mass poverty, disease, precariousness. The UN estimates to end extreme poverty that the total cost per year would be $175 billion, less than 1% of combined income of the richest countries in the world. The richest men in countries make much more money mining the richest of the resources of the poor countries, but there is no move to take part of it to end the suffering of extreme hunger. Nor, of course, are they willing to interrupt their accumulation of monies to deal with the grave threat of climate change. On that sorry note, we must end this part one of my two-part interview with Romana. He sees the need for an immediate mobilization to take two sets of action. For one, quickly retire all fossil fuel burning and replace all uses with sun and wind power. That by building out many small installations and some quite large installations, all deploying cheap, off-the-shelf, very reliable technologies. And the Climate Action Forces then demonstrate the feasibility of this program by pointing to the many cities, many in this country, that have built out just these systems and are on the way to becoming zero carbon, meaning that all the energy they use is produced by zero greenhouse gas technologies. This plan, of course, is absolutely unacceptable to our elites. As Romana has explained in this first part, their plans are completely self-serving, and much of their previous research has gone nowhere. Government-funded research has gone nowhere. That their current efforts in geoengineering create great dangers, as do their plans for great numbers of new allegedly small nuclear plants spread across rural areas. In the second half of this interview, Roman and I will discuss how the struggle between the corporate plan and the environmental and left plan is growing furious, and how the corporate center are using their political and economic power to stifle the on-the-ground actual development that's really happening now of that climate action and environmental program. So, Ramana, talk to you soon. Thanks a lot.